Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:28 PM, that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is May 22nd. Today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I thought I would kick off this week looking at the advanced decline line for the S&P 500. It's been one of the clearest confirmatory indicators for the bull market that started off really in the latter stages of 2008. But one thing that's, I think, particularly worth mentioning right now is that it is not back at its highs. In fact, it's right in the region of the trend mean. Now, generally speaking, in order to clearly confirm that we're in a true bear market, not simply a medium-term correction, but a bear market that has the capacity to last more than a few months, or even into years, we would need to see this trending below the 200-day moving average. That hasn't happened yet, but we are at that moment where if the market is going to pop on the upside and reassert the medium-term uptrend, or I guess the secular bull market hypothesis would have to be reaffirmed by a sustained move to new highs by the primary Wall Street indices. We are at the point where if something untoward were to happen and the wider stock market enters a corrective phase with the majority of shares pulling back, then the advanced decline line could break lower. Now, we did see something to that effect occurring in 2015 and 16. So the really important confirmatory evidence would be if it encounters resistance in the region of the trend mean. Now, we did see something like that back in 2007, and we can see that the advanced decline line, in fact, was losing momentum right in the middle of 2007, dropped below it, encountered resistance in the region of it right in, towards the end of 2007, and then trended downwards. Then, of course, it accelerated lower when everything declined in the third quarter of 2008. So it's an important measure to pay attention to. But so far, it's been reasonably steady. And when we just zoom in and look at it on a daily basis, there is a sequence of lower rally highs over the course of this month. Now, when we then look at the S&P 500 over the same time frame, well, we have had medium-term corrections in the past. There have been occasions where the stock market went through anything up to a year and a half of ranging, and it did that again. But then the breakout failed, and now we're right in the region of the 200-day moving average. The stock market is pausing around this 3,000 level, which is an obvious area of potential resistance. 3,000 was an area of resistance all the way through 2018 and 19, and now it represents the region of the 200-day moving average. Now, when we look at the 1,000-day moving average, it's also one of the most useful arbiters of whether we're in a secular bull market or not. Generally speaking, stock markets don't sustain moves below their 1,000-day moving average in a secular bull market. We had certainly a shock experience in March where it pulled back and sustained the move for about 3 weeks, but then it has popped back above it. So now we have this is now a much easier chart to analyze than perhaps back in March. It was also a reasonably easy chart to monitor back in February, because back then the region of 3,000 really should have held. It didn't. Then we had the move below the trend mean. We've had the massive reaction against the prevailing trend. That is a trend-ending characteristic. Quite normal, after a type 2 top, we get a period of right-hand extension. And arguably, we are on the cusp of that right now. In order to truly confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment, the market is going to have to push back above 3,000. If it can do that, well then, I think we can conclude that investors will have accepted that the massive quantity of liquidity being provided by the central banks all over the world is enough to continue to support asset prices. In the event that 3,000 represents an area of resistance, and we then subsequently see a failure in the region of the 1,000-day moving average, well, that would be confirmatory evidence that we have seen a peak of at least medium-term significance and that we're now moving into a much more volatile period of trading. Quite whether that represents the death knell for the 12-year advance would then subsequently be a big question. But in terms of simply analyzing the chart, this is not the most opportune time to buy because we're at a clear area of potential resistance. And we have a number of uncertainties. The most important of those is that the vast majority of countries have now relaxed their lockdowns to one extent or another. And we don't yet know how successful they're going to be in terms of opening back up again. We certainly know that the lockdowns achieved the flattening of the curve that was hoped for, that the healthcare systems of most countries were not overwhelmed, and that while the death toll has been high, it hasn't represented a catastrophic event in a healthcare scenario. But it has obviously been extremely deleterious in terms of economic potential. And the longer that economic hiatus persists for, the greater the potential that there's going to be lasting damage done. That's certainly been the thought cycle being spouted by the Federal Reserve, which is why they are very unlikely to raise interest rates for at least the next year, potentially 2 or even 3 years. And the quantity of liquidity is likely to continue to increase, and not least because the deficits that governments are running need to be funded. And that means that central banks will be printing the money to achieve that. We are now in a period of modern monetary theory in very clear confirmation of that. We have central banks the world over very clearly printing money to buy the bonds of their governments, and there is no question that there is a monetization of debt going on. Well, that, all other factors being equal, could help to support asset prices because we have this massive quantity of money that is continuing to be pumped into the market. It's been approximately $4 trillion over the course of the last 2 months. We're up now to, it was at $24 trillion in terms of the total assets of the big central banks of the world in here yesterday. It's just a tad below that in here today. But what we've also seen over the course of the last 10 days was that emerging market central banks are now also engaged in quantitative easing. So the Bank of Indonesia is going to buy 25% of all of Indonesia's bonds, or all the new issued bonds. The Philippines is also now engaged in bond buying. Now, this is a very significant departure, because until this week, it was generally considered impossible for emerging market central banks to engage in quantitative easing because they don't generally get to borrow money in their own currencies. And by printing their own currency to buy bonds, and those bonds being denominated in another currency, then they're obviously leaving themselves open to really quite acute loss profiles. But that hasn't stopped the Indonesian rupiah from continuing to appreciate, and the Philippine peso has been one of the firmer currencies over the course of the last while. But when we look at, for example, the Philippines bonds, well, they are universally, well, the vast majority are denominated in US dollars. When we look at Indonesia, and I'm afraid we don't have a composite for that, then we can see, for example, that when we think about the potential in terms of their bonds, well, if the government is buying those bonds with money they're simply printing, then what is the security that a foreign investor is going to have? The obvious effort to support the currency right now is, I think, rather at odds with what's happening in the rest of the emerging markets sector. I think betting on countries trying to support their currencies in an artificial way is probably a head fake in the short term, because China is potentially, at least, on the cusp of devaluing its currency. And the renminbi went to a new reaction low in here today and is back in the region of the lows from September and August. But when we look at this on a longer term basis, then this just doesn't look like anything other than a first step above the long base formation. There has been a prolonged period, 12 years in the making, where the renminbi traded below 7 or stronger than 7. And now this looks like the potential for continued pressure to come to bear on the renminbi. And there's good reason for that. They're now in the middle of a recession. Just today, they abandoned their growth target. Well, that makes sense. They used to have a clockwork mechanism for reporting 10% growth. Nobody really believed it, but everyone was willing to go along with the fiction that it was going to be 10% every year because they were growing quickly. But it's progressively more difficult to grow your economy at 10% the bigger you get. And China's already at that point, so growth has been moderating for years now. So they've now abandoned the growth target because it's a fiction to begin with, but also there is no point in having a growth target when your economy is in recession. They announced $500 billion worth of infrastructure spending and supports for the economy in the Party Congress this week. That is not an awful lot of money for an economy the size of China's. They are terrified, however, of inflating an asset bubble. And property prices have been really very steady and have, in fact, been rising in China since the end of their lockdowns. That's also something that has been evident in other countries because there is no new supply. There are very few people that want to sell their houses because they don't think they'll get the price they want for it. And they don't know where to go during a lockdown or during a period where people are afraid to go outside. So property prices have been stable to rising in the short term. China, however, is terrified of creating a property bubble, so they are inhibited from pulling on the traditional levers. Instead, what they're going to do is concentrate clearly on technological innovation, on ensuring that the Communist Party, above all else, retains power, which means that the social credit score is going to become a central facet of society in China. But the problem, of course, is that against a background of a recession and a population that is not accustomed to enduring recessions, then the social credit score is rather more likely to become a very heavy-handed way of attempting to control the populace. Now, the most important point I think that is worth highlighting is that the Cultural Revolution was also a period where there was a move to inhibit personal freedoms, and it lasted for approximately 12 years. It was also associated with a surge in nationalistic fervor, and it ultimately failed. And there is, of course, the potential that that is exactly what's going to happen with the social credit score as well. The question, of course, that we just do not know the answer to, and we can't yet know, is how effective technological solutions are going to be in terms of continuing to increase the control mechanisms of the party on social gatherings, on the way people live their lives. We are already at a point where they have inserted cameras inside people's homes. So there is obviously a very clear intention to try and lock down on any potential form of dissent, much less waiting for dissent to in fact occur. The significant additional restrictions on freedom in Hong Kong can be viewed in two different ways. The first is that China is sick of dealing with protest movements in Hong Kong, and their tolerance for the protest movement has grown shorter as the recession on the mainland has become more intense. So not only does the additional security laws being passed in Hong Kong serve the purpose of trying to inhibit the protest movement, bringing Hong Kong more into the realm of control from the mainland, but it also helps to stoke nationalistic fervor, and that is generally something that occurs when a totalitarian regime is under threat. So the Hang Seng was down about 5% in here today, but I think the more important point here is we have clear evidence now of resistance coming through in the region of 25,000. The March lows now need to offer support. We need to see a higher reaction low form in order to question that this isn't still a medium-term downtrend that began more than 2 years ago. One thing that I thought was particularly relevant yesterday was the chart I put up of the US-listed Chinese companies. Those have been trending downwards now for more than 2 years, and that is obviously a clear indication of the accounting irregularities that have generally turned up in a number of these companies, Luckin Coffee being the most recent of those. The almost unanimous legislation that was passed in the Senate yesterday was aimed primarily at enforcing accounting standards or US accounting standards on Chinese companies wishing to list. But I think from a broader perspective, it is probably the first nail in the coffin of the listing of Chinese companies in the US. Hong Kong's exchange changed the rules last week to allow dual listings, which was primarily aimed at allowing Alibaba to list in Hong Kong. Alibaba was down today in a rather dynamic manner, and there is clear potential that institutional investors are getting the message that once Alibaba has a listing in Hong Kong, it will quite likely either voluntarily or be forced by the US side or the Chinese side to delist from the USA. And that is a clear potential outcome of the machinations that are going on in terms of the geopolitical environment right now. The unwinding of globalization has been a theme over the course of the last 5 years. The rise of populism has been a symptom of the failure of globalization to improve living standards and to supply alternative forms of employment and improving living standards for millions of people in the developed markets. It was the primary benefit of globalization was to improve the living standards of some of the world's poorest people. It also greatly enhanced the profitability of some of the world's largest corporations, but that was achieved by cutting off the ability of a significant number of less well-educated people from achieving a middle-class lifestyle. And that is, I think, most acutely can be observed in the personal savings as a percentage of disposable income chart, because it's now up to 13.1%. Now, we had a brief spike up to 12% in 2012, and it came straight back down again. But by and large, the trend has been rising now for most of the last 15 years. But the spike that we've just had, it can't simply be because of rising savings. When we have 38 million people in the USA that have lost their jobs, well, their savings rate as a percentage of their disposable income is now zero. Well, if that's the case and they're still being included, then we should see the savings rate decline. What it rather suggests is that they've been excised from the data. And if they have been, then what the personal savings rate jump really represents is that the better off people in society are doing rather well during the period of the coronavirus lockdown. And they are saving more money. And I can certainly think about my own household, where our expenditures have contracted really quite considerably over the last 2 months. Well, that also helps to highlight the fact that we are not all in this together. Some people are doing much better than others, or I think probably the more likely way of defining it is that there is a significant number of people that are doing considerably worse than everybody else. This is going to greatly widen the income disparities between various portions of society, but it is also likely to be a source of further political or polarization. There's already a chasm between the haves and the have-nots, and it's only going to get wider as a result of the lockdowns. Well, viewed from that perspective, there is obviously a clear incentive among politicians to try and get economies open again as quick as possible, because it doesn't matter how much assistance is being provided by various support mechanisms supplied by governments, they're going to be received unequally by various people, depending on their individual circumstances. The only way to get people back in control of their lives is to allow them to work once more. So there is obviously a clear intention to try and ease lockdowns. But of course, that does run the risk of increasing the potential for the virus to start spreading quickly again. And these are some of the big uncertainties that we have. The one certainty we can bank on is that central banks are going to be printing as much money as is required. So that, all of the factors being equal, monetary policy is the clearest tailwind for stock markets. But then we have the bigger question about the health of the wider economy, and how quickly is it that income and spending is going to recover. The chances are that it is going to take time. Now, one thing that we have seen is that some companies have been doing better than others. TJX, for example, has rebounded and it's now in the region of its trend mean, where it has been able to open stores. It has done well, and part of the reason for that is because it's a discounter. We have had so many of the bankruptcies in the retail sector that a lot of inventory is going to have to be liquidated. Well, that is great news for discounters, so they have the potential to benefit in the short term. But of course, the potential also resides in the fact that they're going to be centers for spreading if you've got people milling around inside a store and people flicking through rail after rail of clothes and depositing virus on all of them. This is obviously a significant challenge for these kinds of companies, despite the knee-jerk surge in demand. This is unlikely to be a factor that is really persistent. So there are uncertainties, but then we have to look beyond the short term and think about the medium term and the long term. What are countries going to do to get back to a growth footing? It means there's going to have to be stimulus, and that stimulus is going to have to be aimed clearly at jobs. Well, one thing that we can see, for example, in China, and I think this is likely to be mirrored elsewhere, is that there's going to be an infrastructure build. China is going to concentrate on technology and in, I think, perhaps in energy generation. But iron ore prices have firmed from the upper side of the underlying trading range. So that is positive. It has been a clear bullish phenomenon for Fortescue Metals, for example, which is at a new high. But bigger, more diversified miners have also started to firm, and Rio Tinto, for example, is back above its trend mean. So we are starting to see some speculation that the resources sector is going to benefit in this regard, that there will be infrastructure development. There is certainly a chronic need for infrastructure, and that is true both in emerging and developed markets, and that there is a significant knock-on benefit effect from creating infrastructure, both in terms of creating the conditions for future growth and employing people in the short term. So I think that is likely to be a significant factor in the medium term. And then we think about the metals index. It's still very depressed. In fact, the London Metals Index is back in the region of the lows from 2015 and 16. And when we look at more back history, then we're not all that far away from the lows put in 2008 either. Well, when we think about what the outlook is for a country like India, there is obviously a demographic dividend that India has, and it's going to be a significant factor for India for the next 20 years. China's domestic workforce is aging, and they had the peak prosperity years from their demographic dividend until about 2006. That's part of the reason why all of the growth in China over the course of the last decade has been bought with debt. Before that, they had the demographic dividend to rely on. Now they need to buy it. It's more expensive, it's more difficult, and it requires more technology and more labor-saving devices to generate growth than it did before. Well, India is now in the sweet spot. 50% of the population is under the age of 25. And that is 650 million people. And that is a massive source of labor. Therefore, India is likely to be a buy on the dips for the foreseeable future. Now, the big question I think investors have today is whether we have seen enough of a dip. The one challenge that India has, and it is as a result of the mismanagement of the banking sector over the course of the last few years, is the weakness of the banks. But it has not yet broken down. It is right in the region of the lows. And there is the potential, at least, that lower interest rates and money being made available for mergers within the banking sector, that the dire straits that some of the private banks and the non-bank lenders are in, then there is the potential that the rest of the banking sector can get past this mess in the not so distant future. India is in the process of easing some of the laws it's had on workers' rights, which have been stifling to growth. They are creating special economic zones, which is a policy that China deployed to extreme benefit over during its initial development phases. India has already got an educated population, and its citizens and its international diaspora is one of the most significant in the world. They have got already successful multinational companies that are capable of competing internationally. They have this massive workforce. What they do not have is infrastructure. What they do not have is an ease of moving through the planning process. These are topics that are now being corrected. The creation of special economic zones, which should be achieved by the end of this month, is obviously something that is a very significant development. We also know that India is a volatile market. It does have a tendency to have big pullbacks every few years. We have had a big pullback. In the event that India can ease its lockdowns and get back onto an expansionary footing, then that will be, I think, a clear confirmation for investors that the time has come to jump back into the market. We're perhaps not quite there yet, but it is, I think, looking increasingly likely that if we have not seen the low, we are close to the low. And I think India is likely to be one of the markets that benefits most from the decoupling of the USA and China. The reality is that China has expressed its intention to become the global hegemon for most of the last decade. It's really only in the last 3 or 4 years that they have met with any resistance at all. China is obviously very eager for the international status quo to remain intact. There is zero chance of that now, and that is all to India's benefit. It's also a benefit to Vietnam. And the challenge for Vietnam, despite the fact that the market has been rebounding and continues to rebound, and it is a high-growth market, and has dealt effectively with the threat from the coronavirus, it's that the population isn't as large as India's, and that its manufacturing capacity is already at capacity. Then, of course, you have the fact that Vietnam has a land border with China, and it is ruled by the Communist Party. The way that I would consider Vietnam's Communist Party is that it is like China's Communist Party, except it's China's Communist Party probably in 1990 or 2000 rather than in 2020. In other words, Vietnam is probably about 25 years behind China in terms of the political development of its Communist Party. But the stock market, at least, is rebounding back up towards the region of the trend mean, and the currency has been stable relative to some of the volatility we've seen in other places. Well, one of the countries that has had the most volatility in terms of the currency is Brazil, and it has been a significant center for the spread of the virus. But the Brazilian real has been steadying over the course of the last 2 weeks. It is now testing the dollar sequence of higher reaction lows. The stock market has also started to steady in here, and it is at least holding this 60,000 level. But I think it is really very clear that the size of the pullbacks we've seen on a number of international indices are substantially larger than what we've seen on Wall Street. And that also helps to clearly signal where the leaders are in terms of the global economy. There is a clear tendency to look at emerging market valuations and European valuations and to conclude that there must be a value opportunity. But the reality is that Europe in particular is trading at a significant valuation discount to Wall Street for a reason. China, which dominates the emerging market segment, is trading at a discount to Wall Street for a reason. Both of them are tied to governance. Now, Europe did have an important announcement in here this week from Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron that they are considering issuing federal debt. Now, the amount that's being proposed is comparatively small relative to the total debt load of the region. But if Europe goes down the route of issuing federal debt, then that is a further step towards federalization of the entire region. The way that the EU is structured, we just might simply refer to it as federalization by stealth, and that does appear to be what is underway. The stock market at least has held the rebound so far, and it has been ranging for most of the last 6 weeks. It's going to have to push up and out of this range and then to push back above the 200-day moving average. But one thing that I think is relevant to point out is that the 200-day moving average is quite close to crossing down and below the 1,000-day moving average. And that is a clear indication of an overall bear market. It's equally true of what we see on the Russell 2000, where the index has rebounded and it is quite clearly coming back up towards the region of 1400, which is the lower side of the overhead range, and potentially going back up to test the region of the 200-day moving average as well. If it can continue to rally, then there's the potential, at least, that the two moving averages will not cross over one another. But the problem, I think, for investors is that the easy part of the rebound has already occurred, that we are likely to see some volatility emerge eventually. And that's part of the reason why gold has been so strong. And gold prices, having pulled back yesterday, were in positive territory in here today. Of course, gold is the barometer against which all other currencies are measured. So it has not just simply been firm in US dollars, but has been firming in a whole range of currencies. So that's a very significant factor. One thing that I think is particularly interesting is when we look at the performance of the gold mining sector, it has now completed its base formation, and a sustained move back below $30 would be required to question that this isn't a new medium-term bull market. But when we look at the gold-silver ratio, I think we are presented with some interesting information. The first is that silver was at an historic discount relative to gold until quite recently, and now it is back below the 100 level. So gold is now on only 20 or 98 times the price of silver. Generally, silver does outperform during bull markets. But then it does also tend to lag gold prices. And silver didn't really start to outperform until 2003. It then fell much faster than gold in 2008 and bottomed really in late 2008 before outperforming to its peak in 2011. Well, let's just look at the gold price, because gold bottomed in the early 2000s. Silver didn't really start to outperform gold until 2003, which was well after gold had completed its base formation. Silver underperformed gold during the crash in 2008, and then it subsequently outperformed in a substantial manner. Well, gold has already broken out of its base formation. It has clearly demonstrated that it is capable of sustaining the move up and out of its base. Silver, on the other hand, is still within its base formation, but it is only now just beginning to outperform gold. If we are in fact in a new medium-term bull market for gold prices, then it is reasonable to expect that silver will outperform gold for the trending parts of that bull market. And silver has at least rebounded back above the $15 area to confirm the failed downside break, and it is quite likely that we are going to see it breaking out at some point this year. But the challenge in the short term is that it's a little overbought in the short term. So we may see some consolidation. And then, of course, we have the fact that platinum has also been able to clearly signal a failed downside break, and now it is right in the region of the trend mean, but also quite likely to sustain a move back above $1,000 sometime this year. And that would also signal a return to outperformance relative to gold. The fact that platinum is trading at such a wide discount to the gold price when it has historically traded at a premium is another indication of just how cheap some of these precious metals really are. In fact, the vast majority of silver miners, which had been able to make a business concentrating on silver for all of the bull market, most of them had to switch over to producing gold during the bear market because they could not produce silver economically. That's obviously a challenge for the market. So if silver is going to outperform, it does suggest that some of the silver miners will also be among those that perform strongly. And Pan American Silver has been doing better. Fresnillo has been plagued with not being able to achieve its growth targets, but it did pop on the upside in here this week to break its downtrend and to put on a new recovery high. So there is obviously some interest returning to the silver market. The big picture, of course, is that central banks the world over are printing money to try and stoke economic activity and protect their economies. In doing so, they are flagrantly abusing the purchasing power of their respective currencies. The precious metals are the easiest way to hedge against that risk. So investors are using precious metals as a hedge against the worst proclivities of governments and central banks, and in full knowledge that central banks are serial bubble blowers, and they are currently running the significant risk of inflating another bubble. I'm slowly beginning to appreciate the argument for why Shopify should be doing better. But it's now a $100 billion company. The price has gone up like a proverbial rocket. The only way to really appreciate it is on a log scale. When we look at it on a log scale, then the size of the pullbacks looks a little bit more consistent outside of the big one that we had in March. But even on a log scale, the pace of the advance is picking up. It is rapidly approaching the psychological $1,000 level, and it's trading on a PE around 1800. So this is getting to be rather eye-watering. Now, there is obviously the growth and the profit ability of the company that they might even make a profit with the growth that they're getting from the businesses that operate on their platform. There's even the potential that some of the food delivery services might make a profit because of the bonus that they're getting from home deliveries. But it's quite likely that these are short-term phenomena in nature. Then, when we look at Amazon, which has been one of the biggest beneficiaries of the coronavirus, having had the big rebound in March and April, it has been ranging. It put in a downside Q reversal yesterday and followed through on the downside in here today. When we look at the Nasdaq, it was in positive territory in here today. It also posted a downside key yesterday. That followed the downside key we saw earlier in the month. What this is at least saying to me is that traders are softening up the market. And these stabs on the downside, particularly when they're occurring in the region of the previous all-time peak and the psychological 10,000 level, it suggests to me that we are at a point where there is certainly scope for profit taking. Personally, I was more interested in buying gold shares back and investing in precious metals back in March, rather than investing in stock markets. I'm personally not going to be buying any stock markets until I see either a significant pullback or that we see them pushing on to new recovery highs. That's just, I think, the trader in me, not wanting to chase, but also wanting some frame of reference to think about where something might clearly look wrong before speculating. When we think about the broader picture, then the cloud sector does continue to represent a bullish phenomenon. Microsoft announced in here this week that they have deployed the biggest supercomputer in the world, completely devoted to artificial intelligence. So that is obviously going to be part of their growth strategy. The challenge for a company like Apple is that they have got a very significant exposure to China, and the share is right in the region of its peak. When we think about the fact that Google is being sued by a number of states, then that also represents a challenge as its share comes back to the region of its peak. So I think that there are a lot of uncertainties that are outstanding. The one uncertainty that we don't have is that monetary policy beats most other factors most of the time, and the quantity of money that's being printed is clearly helping to support stock markets in the short term. I do, however, think that the increasing geopolitical tensions that we have and the willingness of politicians to lean on China because they believe it's an election-winning strategy is something that is going to weigh on sentiment eventually. What we have certainly seen a lot of is some enthusiasm about the provision of a vaccine. I personally do not think it is likely we're going to see an additional or a second wave of infections because we have international awareness. Of course, we have to get over the first wave of infections first, and we're not quite there yet either. I think if we were to go back and look historically, it's not so much that there were waves, but rather that the virus didn't go global at nearly the same pace in 1918 and 19 that it has done on this occasion. And that is a mitigating factor for a second wave of infections. That doesn't mean we're not going to have a lot of uncertainty. There are currently more than 100 vaccines under development, and it's likely that some of them will work. Moderna has pulled back over the course of this week, particularly following its very hasty announcement of a revenue raise and the way that they made some of their test data available from a very limited number of cases to support the argument for their valuation. That's not the kind of thing that is confidence-inducing from the perspective of investors, but at least the share has found support in the region of the upper side of the underlying range. So perhaps the pause will be a pause within the bull market rather than an unwinding of the entire advance. Moderna is the share that is furthest along in terms of developing a vaccine. But we're still a way away from getting it permitted. And convincing the general population of the world that these new genetically based vaccines are safe is not going to be something that can simply be brushed aside. When we look at the movement internationally, which is anti-vaccination, then trying to convince people of the safety of a vaccine is no easy task. And certainly there is a clear temptation to think that the process is rushed. On top of that, we don't have a vaccine for any one of the coronaviruses we're aware of. There hasn't really been any need for it in the past. The one thing that we certainly know is that this is quite beneficial for the biotechnology sector. And the Nasdaq Biotech Index has been going sideways for 5 years. It rallied spectacularly in the period from 2012 to 2015 because of the commercialization of some of their therapies, and particularly in the immuno-oncology space. It's in fact some of the lessons learned from immuno-oncology are being deployed today in the search for a vaccine. At least we have some evidence from immuno-oncology that the methods are safe. But that is going to have to be communicated in an effective way for people to have confidence. And confidence rebuilding is going to be a significant factor. The one thing we know is that the stock market has had a V-shaped recovery. The economy is likely to have a U-shaped recovery. We're going to have to see earnings growth start to pick up in a significant fashion to justify valuations. The one thing we also know is that there's going to be very significant efforts underway to boost growth. On the one hand, that's going to boost technology, because technology will now be given the opportunity to say that they have provided the solutions necessary to support the economy come what may. So investors will be more willing to bet on technology going forward. That's going to be particularly true of biotechnology. And if the permitting process for new drugs is streamlined, which is a potential outcome, then that could be potentially very lucrative for the biotechnology sector. And most particularly if they start to attack the chronic diseases sector, massive, I think, cost centers and profit centers for the pharmaceutical industry, cost centers for governments, profit centers for the pharmaceutical industry, like diabetes and arthritis, or heart ailments. Well, that does suggest that biotech is going to be one of the more exciting sectors going forward. The cloud sector, deep learning, artificial technology, coupled with 5G, is going to take the, I guess the best way, or the way that I think of it at least, is that when we look at how technology has evolved, it has been dematerialized. So everything that we used to have a physical object for, or a physical place to go, now is located virtually on our phones. So that's the ultimate way that technology evolves, is dematerialization. I think that when we think about artificial intelligence and deep learning, it has always tended to happen somewhere else. Whereas with the evolution of 5G, not only is that going to produce faster speeds but less lag, it's going to open up a realm of new possible applications which will give access to artificial intelligence and deep learning and massive computing power directly on our phones, which is likely to represent the next iteration of the app in technology, or the app economy, over the course of the next decade. Cloud, and the fact that it is a labor-saving device, is going to be deployed in an extensively large number of new companies, simply because if companies pass up the opportunity to cut their costs, they're going to become less competitive. They're going to have to deploy that kind of technology. So we're likely to see some kind of transition within the technology sector. There are obviously going to be some companies that do better than others, and there are some that are highly levered to the continued provision of liquidity. The fact that growth can be achieved with free money, then that is something that is going to give additional legs to the startup environment. So those are some of the sectors that are potentially going to benefit, and gold is the hedge against all of that, and it is rising, whereas government bond yields have been going sideways, and the relative comparison between the use of gold as a hedge against equities rather than bonds is probably a use case that is going to be explored significantly over the coming years. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.